Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
You're listening to episode 217 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the great Dan Feinberg, The Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. What's happening, Dan?
Just recovering after a busy, busy weekend last weekend in Austin for ATX Television Festival. Turns out I require more recovery than I used to back in my youth. Ain't that just the way? But anyway, it was a fun weekend in Austin. The festival organizers and whatnot, as always, put together a great event. And while certainly there was some strangeness related to the looming specter of the strike, well, maybe not looming, just the existing specter of the strike, I would say that it was a generally joyful festival of television love, as it's supposed to be.
Yeah, I miss being there. That's always one of the great events on the TV calendar every year. And if you haven't been, highly recommend it if you're a diehard fan of the industry, because your access to creatives and talent is unparalleled.
I would mention that at least a half dozen people, probably more, mentioned having been in the audience for our only previous TV's Top 5 live event and said that they hoped that we would do one in the future. And I second that hope. I hope that we will also return and do another live TV's Top 5 at ATX TV Festival in the future.
Thirded, my friend. In other news, we're coming up on week 6 of the writer's strike. SAG has voted to overwhelmingly approve a strike should it resort to that in negotiations with the AMPTP breakdown. And the DGA has reached a tentative deal of their own. So lots to get to this week. But before we do, we're going to start off with headlines.
Number one.
Leading off, Vanessa Bayer comedy series I Love That For You has been canceled after a single season at Showtime, likely completing the content slate review by Chris McCarthy, who added The Cabler to his purview last year and has dropped or canceled a number of scripted series in favor of spinoffs of Billions and Dexter. Dan, this is kind of a bummer because it had been in limbo. The show had been in limbo for a year.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that I'd love to get more clarity on from you, how that ends up sitting around for as long as it did, because that was one which aired a long time ago and has just kind of been sitting there. And
I mean, it probably extended options for the cast. They were looking at it, probably weighing the finance. I had heard that all of the scripts for a second season were already done. And ultimately, it probably, like everything else, came down to money and a budget issue.
Well, I hope the writers who wrote the second season were appropriately compensated for that labor. But
I mean, it'll be shopped and we'll see if it winds up anywhere. But yeah, not a lot of deals being done right now in the TV community.
Definitely not. No, just it is still odd, though, to see a show be in limbo for that long. And I think probably kind of logic tended to dictate that it wasn't going to get renewed. I think that if it had been, you know, nominated for awards or something, maybe that would have made a big difference. But yeah, little perplexed on that one.
Yeah,
but
it doesn't necessarily fit into the programming buckets Chris McCarthy has outlined for Showtime. Or is it called Showtime with Paramount Plus? Or
I don't know.
Paramount Plus with Showtime?
Anything is called anymore at all.
Paramount Plus minus? I don't know. Anyway, moving on.
The CW continues to push into sports and has picked up Inside the NFL, the weekly highlight and interview show that spent its past two seasons streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Or Paramount Plus with Showtime? No, probably not. The Nexstar-controlled CW is the fourth home for the series, which spent 31 years on HBO, which is honestly, I think, where I still thought it was, before moving to Showtime in 2008. And speaking of the CW, the network's coverage of LIV Golf will continue on as scheduled, as the Startup League is being merged back into the PGA Tour in strange ways that are causing much, I don't know, somewhere between head-scratching and garment-rending within the golf world. Weird story. Whole year of conflict between LIV Golf and the PGA Tour comes down to PGA Tour ultimately taking money. So very
from the Saudis.
Not a great look for the PGA Tour, but I suppose some people will be happy to have all of their favorite golfers back under one roof after having watched all of their favorite golfers tear each other to shreds in the press for a year.
Elsewhere, ABC is developing a new take on Extreme Makeover Home Edition, with the founders of The Home Edit set to host the new incarnation of the former unscripted series that aired for 9 seasons on the network. So we're going to play a game here at TV's Top 5, and I hope you'll play along with us. So let's monitor this show and see when ABC officially hits the panic button that it needs more content to fill its schedule during the writer's strike. And of course, we should note we did have the head of ABC's programming on a couple episodes ago, and he talked all about the network's decision to go largely all unscripted for the fall, with the exception of repeats of Abbott Elementary. And this is obviously all because of the writer's strike. So does ABC have enough content in the pipeline as he suggested, or is this Extreme Makeover project that's in development right now kind of the backup going, well, if this goes a long time and really starts to affect our January roster, we might need to go stuff into the summer, et cetera. So we're going to use this as a guinea pig and see when ABC hits the panic button.
Extreme Makeover Home Edition is one of those titles where if you had asked me if it was still a show that was airing in some capacity on ABC or Freeform or somewhere at this moment, I think I probably would have said 50-50 it is. Similarly, I could not tell you with any real certainty if Wife Swap or Celebrity Wife Swap have aired in the past couple of years. Let's see. I couldn't tell you if The Nanny or Super Nanny have aired in the past couple of years. I am certain that there has not been a new installment of The Swan in several years. But, you know, honestly, there's so much what's old is new on television that honestly, even if it weren't just strike insurance, I would think, sure, why not? It's a recognizable title. And once we eliminated the original thing that the Extreme Makeover shows were making over, which is to say humans, and just made it into a home edition, whatever. It's harmless, painless entertainment. Anyway, on the more painful side, for people who are fans of things, HBO has canceled Perry Mason after a 2-season run that included 2 sets of showrunners on the series, which was executive produced by Robert Downey Jr. and starred Matthew Rhys. Lots of unhappiness, at least on my Twitter feed, but could totally be one of those situations in which my Twitter feed is not necessarily representative of anything. I don't know. It's a show that struggled to find its own footprint and to convince people who were tentative about the brand to begin with that they wanted to watch it, which doesn't mean that the people who tuned in didn't like it. The second season felt much more on brand than the first, which felt basically like a 10 episode premise pilot. Just too bad. It was definitely always a tremendously well-produced show, and the cast was quite excellent. And yeah, but also not necessarily a show that was so good that I'm going to get outraged and angry about it, just minorly disappointed on the behalf of its fans.
And in news from late last week, Padma Lakshmi is leaving Top Chef after 19 seasons on the Bravo franchise. Dan, this is one of your favorite shows, so I imagine you have, as the kids say, the feelings.
I have the sadness, because the show will not be the same without her. She is very, very, very crucial to the energy of the show. She had done it basically since the second season. First season was not her, but really, truly one of the very, very good to possibly great hosting jobs on television that she did on that show. And her ability to set the tone for the show was very, very crucial to its success, which has been ongoing and varied. I think probably she is more integral than any of the other pieces. You know, I like Tom Colicchio an awful lot. I think the show probably could exist without him. I feel as if there have been multiple seasons without Gail Simmons of Food and Wine magazine. I like her very much when she's on it, but when she's not, I don't miss her. It will be tough, however, to find the exact person capable of replacing her. At least one person in response to my disappointment or sadness on Twitter said that Kristen Kitch, who was on the show multiple seasons and has her own show on NatGeo/Disney+, etc., etc., that she would be a potentially good replacement. And I think that's actually completely true. I think if Kristen Kitch wanted to do it, she would be a great candidate. I happen to think her show is a really, really good show, and so I'd love to see her get to do more of that. And look, if Padma wanted to do other things, wants to do other things, if she wants to concentrate on Taste the Nation on Hulu, which I think is a great show and was even better in its second season than it was in its very good first season, she's obviously entitled to do that. Hosting any show for this length of time is you know, it's a lot. But on the other hand, her tone setting on that show has been a major portion of its success in both better and worse seasons, and so she will be missed. The show is ending this most recent season this week, and yeah, I will be sad to see her go, but she's entitled to do whatever she wants.
Number two.
Up second this week, the Chris Licht era at CNN is officially over. Warner Brothers Discovery CEO David Zaslav informed staff June 7th that Licht, the former exec producer of Stephen Colbert's The Late Show, was out after an eventful 13-month run. Joining us to discuss the move and what's next for CNN is THR's media and business reporter and the hardest working man in showbiz, Alex Weprin. Alex, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
So getting started, the surprise here from my vantage point anyway is not so much that he's out, but that he's out so soon. What do you think was the final nail in the coffin here?
Yeah, I mean, there's really no question that 15,000 word story in The Atlantic was the thing that ultimately did him in. There were certainly other things that led up to that. The kind of disastrous Donald Trump town hall that, you know, Christiane Amanpour called out in her commencement address to Columbia University. The fact that the morning show that he created, which was supposed to be his first like tentpole program, imploded, and when he fired Don Lemon after just moving him from prime time to the mornings, the fact that the ratings were either static or in decline, and the fact that it seems like most of the high profile anchors say they didn't really have a relationship with him. They didn't know him. And as a result, you know, they didn't know if they could trust him. So, I suspect this was probably going to happen eventually. And in fact, I would have bet in the next couple months, maybe 6 months. The Atlantic story certainly hastened the pace of everything.
I mean, I love that list of the fact that and the fact that and the fact that there were plenty and plenty of reasons why this was not apparently a successful tenure. Why do you think, was it simply the volume of the Atlantic story? Like, everyone only seems to be discussing that story, not so much in terms of individual things within it, but it was 15,000 words of one thing after another.
And the access that the Atlantic was granted was insane. Like, who signs off on that?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he was there like at 6 a.m. with his, you know, with his trainer working out. I do think that the quote, I'll encourage people to read the article, but the quote of him talking about his predecessor, Jeff Zucker, with his trainer is the one that's going to resonate for a long time. But, you're right. There wasn't like a singular headline from that story. It was rather a lot of rope, and Chris used every inch of it to seemingly seal his fate. It was just everything that, you know, it kind of, I think, here's the thing. When Tim Alberta, who's the reporter at The Atlantic who wrote the story, when he started following Licht last year, I think everyone was kind of hoping it would be a positive story. At the time, he hadn't really done any major moves yet. And so, you know, he was going to make all these changes. He was going to launch this morning show. He was going to, you know, change these specials in primetime. And what happened was, even as Alberta followed him, everything kind of flopped. And the more time he spent with Chris, the more apparent it became that he didn't really have a relationship with a lot of the people that worked for him. And, you know, what I think Chris hoped would be a very positive story about himself ended up being something that just really did him in.
Like, to my perspective, it simultaneously feels like there are two very different but obviously connected things at play here. One being that Chris Licht might have been very much the wrong person for this job. He seems not to have had really the background for it. He obviously came from Colbert and all of that. But also at the same time, he kind of arrived at a house on fire, and then just the water that he attempted to throw on it didn't work. But I can't imagine that anyone would have been able to reverse that. How do you look at the balance of those two things, the wrong man for the wrong job and the job that was imploding anyway aspect of this?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Like this, well, you know, CNN was not like swimming along in perfect shape, and, you know, it was already kind of in trouble. It had, you know, been trying to find a voice for itself for, you know, pretty much since Donald Trump left office, since Jeff Zucker, you know, left. So it needed a turnaround. You know, David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, he apparently picked Chris without, you know, even talking to any other people. He just knew it was going to be Chris. And Chris, you know, has had success as a producer for Morning Joe on MSNBC. CBS This Morning, you know, even though that never became a hit show, it did show that you could have a serious news program in the morning. And again, at Colbert, where he is partly credited with kind of helping turn that show around at a time when it was having personnel issues. But the truth is he'd never been an executive, you know, in that level, in that capacity before. And, you know, dealing with things like budgets and human resources and legal and, you know, all of these things that kind of take up a lot of your time if you're the boss. Meant that he really wasn't doing much in the way of programming. And that was supposed to be his bread and butter, programming and anchor relationships. Gail King and Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski all had great things to say about him, but the CNN anchors barely knew him. So, you know, it was a weird situation where he was taking over a network that was in trouble, and he wasn't leaning into what his supposed strengths were when he got there.
So what's next for CNN in the interim?
So for now, they've got interim leadership. It's Amy Antelis, who's the kind of the head of talent relations, who's kind of the CNN veteran. David Levy is the COO. He's a David Zaslav lieutenant. He's going to run the commercial and business side of things. Virginia Mosley is kind of the head of the newsroom. And there's the head of programming, whose name I'm forgetting off the top of my head, is sticking around as well to go and oversee the daily programming. That's purely an interim play. They are going to look for someone, but the problem is the 2024 election's coming up. Like, they have to get on top of that. So I guess it's going to be up to this interim leadership to do that, and figure out how they're going to plan for and cover 2024. And it's also not clear when and if they hire a replacement for Chris. Is that person going to have the same job Chris had, or is it going to be a diminished role where they just oversee programming and David Levy oversees the entire business side of the operation? I think that's likely.
Yeah, that's kind of the structure that NBC Universal has done in terms of, you know, looking at, they have Frances Berwick overseeing all the business side of it all, and then Susan Rovner overseeing all the creatives, for example.
Yeah, although I'll note it, on the news side, Cesar Conde at NBC News Group does oversee all of that himself. And he is, in fact, not a journalist. His background is as an executive.
Do we have a sense of, I guess we do have a sense of kind of what it was that Licht thought his philosophy was going to be, that it was sort of the idea of returning CNN to this idea of balanced neutrality or whatever. I mean, it's some mumbo jumbo, but I've seen a lot of the word neutrality around. Do we have a sense of what it is that David Zaslav thinks would be an alternative that would make him happy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Zaslav has spoken quite a bit about what his vision for CNN is, and a lot of it seems to be about making sure there are Republicans that appear on CNN. Because they, you know, and it's true that, you know, during a lot of the Zucker years, certainly towards the tail end, a lot of Republicans just wouldn't even bother going on CNN. But it's not clear, you know, what is a neutral kind of return to, you know, this kind of central, you know, this center position? Like, it's kind of vague and amorphous. The only thing he's really said is, you know, he wants both sides represented on TV, which, you know, fine. But, like, you know, what exactly does that mean in terms of calling out BS? What does it mean in terms of, you know, deciding your news coverage? Like, you know, not everything's going to be perfectly 50-50. And it's been quite vague, and, you know, even Licht kind of had a hard time, you know, figuring out what exactly that meant. And that's one of the issues that I heard from CNNers. They didn't entirely understand what the mission was. You know, they weren't opposed to like interviewing Donald Trump or interviewing Republicans. It's just, you know, how do you do that? What's the format? And how do you kind of push back against BS? And so that's kind of, you know, one of the problems that they've had. And it's not clear that it's going to end here because David Zaslav still seems to have that vision for CNN.
So are there any candidates that you can think of that would be right for this job? I mean, obviously, this is a big job that doesn't exactly have a great success rate attached to it, at least not right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is like, you know, the new version of like being the president of a broadcast network. You know, it's a great job for a couple of years, then you're fired. You know, internally, Amy Antelis is seen as the favorite. She is the person with the great relationships with anchors and talent. And I think at a news network, that's probably the most important thing to have. You know, you need your anchors need to trust the leadership. They need to have someone they can talk to, correspondents as well. Externally, there aren't a lot of great candidates. You know, as I wrote in a piece the other day, Noah Oppenheim recently left NBC News, but of course, he was quite controversial at NBC. He's currently writing fiction, you know, for NBC and Netflix. He's got that Zero Day show.
And which we'll talk about later.
Yep. And, you know, so someone mentioned he was the former president of Fox News and CBS News, David Rhodes. He's someone that whose name came up. He currently works for Comcast and at Sky in the UK. But like, you know, there aren't any obvious candidates. And the truth is, this is going to be a very high profile, difficult job. And I think a lot of people just aren't going to be interested in it.
Like, that's my question after all this is, is this actually a good job at the moment? Like, I can sort of accept the idea that whatever it was, and I, you know, said again, it was a house on fire when Chris Licht came in. You could view it if you wanted to as the house has been burnt down. Now it's a chance to do new construction. But is this even a good plot of land at this point?
What I would say is, like, if you were given the opportunity to reimagine CNN for the digital age, maybe it could be a good job, you know, but the truth is, I think Warner Brothers Discovery kind of used CNN as kind of their toy to play with in the digital space. They'll figure out some way to work it into Max at some point. And so, you know, if all you really get if you join CNN is the linear television network and CNN.com, it's not nothing, but, you know, it's not a growth business. It's not something that you can invest in and grow something new necessarily. And so the result is that I think it's less appealing. Maybe they change and pivot and say, hey, we're going to hire someone that's going to, you know, have the opportunity to kind of figure out the strategy for bringing CNN into the future. But that seems unlikely to me.
I feel like a digital version of CNN, a CNN plus, if you will, seems like just a really great idea. And I don't know why they don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, look, I get both sides of that because, like, you know, CNN plus was a big bet on figuring out what the future should be. The criticisms, which were fair, was that, like, you know, it was kind of a low rent version of CNN. And like, why would people pay for something that's like not CNN plus, but is like CNN minus? You know, you're getting, it's like not quite as good as the real CNN, but you have to pay for it. So I understand that too. And, you know, the background at the time was that, you know, CNN executives were saying, oh, we could always, at some point in the future, we'll just put the regular CNN on CNN plus. And people were, well, I was like, well, then why would I pay for what's on CNN plus? Like, you know, what's the point? So, you know, that's true, but like, it's a joke, but like, you know, someone needs to be thinking about what's next. And it's not clear that whoever takes over is going to get that opportunity.
Excellent. That sounds like a good and very speculative and uncertain place to end this conversation. Thanks so much for breaking down the week's news with us, as always, Alex.
All right. My pleasure.
Thanks, Alex. And you can follow all of Alex's reporting on THR.com and follow him on Twitter at Alex Weprin. Thanks again, Alex.
Number three.
For our next two segments, we're talking about, oh yeah, labor unrest. Again, more. On the other hand, it's expanding. But of course, we knew it was going to be. So our next two segments, we're talking a little bit about where things are and where things are going. Up first, the Directors Guild has reached a tentative agreement with the studios and streamers. The union's 19,000 members now have until June 23rd to approve or reject the deal, which includes some protections against AI, and what the DGA is calling a historic 13% cumulative wage increase over the next 3 years. Leslie, where do we want to start with the agreement that the DGA has reached and the reaction, at least that we've been able to see thus far, to that agreement?
Yeah, well, the DGA came to a deal. This was late Saturday night into Sunday morning after negotiating all, for the better part of Saturday. And the DGA's current contract expires June 30th, along with SAG's. And the timing of this deal is really interesting because SAG was in the middle of asking its members to vote to approve a strike authorization, which would allow the negotiating committee that represents the actors union the ability to call a strike if negotiations, which are now underway and started this week on Wednesday, with the AMPTP, the group that represents the studios and the streamers. So the DGA came to a deal before the results of the SAG vote, which were overwhelmingly positive. So 98% of that union, and we'll get to that next.
You're spoiling our next segment, Leslie. Spoiler!
With 98% of SAG, of the SAG-AFTRA union voted to approve of a strike. And the DGA, in the middle of all of that, accepted a deal and has, which has already been ratified by the board. And now, as you said, Dan, it is out to members to vote whether to approve or reject the deal and send the DGA's negotiating committee back to the table. So specific details were sent out to members late Wednesday. Those include a new formula for foreign streaming residuals that are based on a platform subscriber total, gains in global residuals, and additional pay days for post-production work. But there is specific language in this document, and it is massive. So I'll let our readers who are interested in getting into the weeds find that document. It's over on THR.com. Our terrific labor reporter, Katie Kilkenny, wrote it. You can access the full document on our website or on the DGA's website. But the language is already kind of being picked apart on socials, as you can imagine. So one of the things that we've seen is, for example, Steven Estenite, the writer and director whose credits include Spartacus and Daredevil, and who is a member of both guilds, is urging his fellow DGA members to vote no on the deal. He wrote, quote, "This isn't the time to accept table scraps and call them historic." He argued that the wage increases don't keep up with the expected average rate of inflation in the U.S., among other issues. Other members, meanwhile, are claiming that there are gaping loopholes in streaming residual increases, plus the DGA gained zero insight into streaming platform viewership, and they want the Directors Guild to harness the leverage of the moment to maximize gains instead of settling for a deal. So the other side, meanwhile, DGA President Leslie Linka-Glatter has said the deal, quote, "recognizes the future of our industry is global and respects the unique and essential role of directors and their teams as we move into that future." And speaking of Glatter, her Netflix show, Zero Day, starring Robert De Niro, was shut down this week after members of the WGA picketed the filming location in New York. Members of IATSE and others refused to cross the picket line, and production was suspended until after the labor strife is concluded. But the optics of the president of the DGA continuing work while also accepting a deal with the studios and the streamers, it's not going over well, to say the least. Several writers that I spoke with on the picket line this week mentioned feeling surprised but not completely shocked that the DGA would reach a deal with the AMPTP after less than a month of negotiations. And after, more importantly, guild leaders stood side by side with the WGA and other unions at the WGA's first rally following its May 2nd decision to go out on strike. And that was a pretty legendary meeting because you had everyone from the Teamsters to the DGA to SAG-AFTRA, everything in between, stand up on stage and tell members that they are with the WGA, that they stand by and support the WGA. So now here you have, after less than a month of negotiations, the DGA taking a deal. So the sentiment, at least from what I've hearing so far, is not exactly going in the DGA's direction. But again, The specific details and the language of the DGA's proposed deal has been out for less than 24 hours as we record this. A lot of folks are declining to comment until after the DGA's membership weighs in. So you've got, like Dan said, that's coming by the end of the day, June 23rd. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with that. So the timing, again, is interesting. And I'm going to take us straight into our next segment.
Number four.
SAG-AFTRA, that's the union that represents actors, they overwhelmingly voted to approve of a strike should those talks with the AMPTP break down during negotiations, which are now, as we record this, in the early days. So the Guild's negotiating committee has 3 weeks. That's it. 3 weeks to reach a deal with the studios and streamers before its contract, like the DGA's, expires on June 30th. So, and SAG-AFTRA is the biggest branch. It's Hollywood's largest union with 160,000 members, and 98% of them voted to authorize the negotiating committee to call a strike if needed. So what you're seeing here is you've got SAG, which is a little bit more closely aligned with the WGA in terms of specific deal points. Yes, AI is on the table for everyone, but it more directly impacts writers and actors than it does directors. So one of the other things that they're looking for, in addition to protections from AI, is changing the rules around self-tape auditions alongside wage increases and streaming residuals that also account for global viewership. So this is a massive moment in the industry. While we've talked on the show about a possible three-union strike, what happens with the DGA's vote? What happens with SAG's three-week window to negotiate a deal that is far more in line with the WGA? And we obviously saw what happened with those negotiations. So a lot of the sentiment right now is, does it behoove SAG to rush negotiations in the next 3 weeks? Or is it fair to expect that actors will join writers out on strike? Should that happen? First of all, we should say that an actor strike would immediately halt any remaining U.S. productions that have been able to continue filming during the writer strike. And it would come 2 years after COVID forced a similar work stoppage from which the industry is still recovering. So the actors' demands, like I said, they do have the similar overlap with the WGA, although many of the core demands from the writers are specific to that profession, i.e. span and protections of writers' rooms. So we've already seen actors out on the picket lines in support of their fellow, in support of their writers. Mark Ruffalo, Jason Sudeikis, many others have often been pounding the pavement. But the last time the actors went out on strike against the major film and TV studios was more than four decades ago. So this is truly a landmark moment, and it's something that the entire industry is basically waiting and holding its breath. Will the DGA approve or reject of its tentative deal with the streamers and the studios? What happens with the SAG negotiations? This is a pivotal moment in our industry, to say the least.
And there's no way necessarily for us to, we can read the tea leaves, but we can only read the tea leaves so far. Like, I think that that's been the interesting thing. If, you know, we talk over and over again about social media bubbles and all of this. And if one were to base one's sense of how the DGA deal is being received based on my Twitter feed, it would be largely negative. But I don't have any way of knowing how representative that is. Like, I feel like most of the people who I follow on Twitter and whose responses to things I follow are simultaneously members of both the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild. And I think people who have those two loyalties have a different perspective on what accepting a deal means for the directors. I think if you have the Writers Guild hat as well, I think you would feel like it was not necessarily such a good deal. I think you would think that it was a deal that did not necessarily lend itself profitably to the demands of the Writers Guild. And so it doesn't necessarily feel like a deal that one would be able to work off of. I think if you were exclusively a director, maybe it would seem a good deal more appealing. I think in those cases, you wouldn't be looking at it as what did the DGA get that the Writers Guild could then build off of? What did the DGA get that SAG could then build off of, etc.? And so I do wonder what the difference, and we're never, I don't know that we're ever going to find this out, because I don't know when we get vote totals, you know, if anyone's going to say, okay, but hyphenates voted at this percentage and whatever, whereas exclusively DGA members voted this way. But definitely it feels to me as if the people who have two hats feel as if this deal serves ultimately neither of their hats, whereas the people with only one hat feel as if, okay, there is progress here. They can look at the raise in money and compensation and go, okay, 5% now, 13% within 3 years, et cetera. Does that account for inflation and all of that? Well, you know, Stephen DeKnight does not think so. And other people who...
Here's one that just came in not too long ago. This is from Warren Light, former TV's top five guest, who joined us recently to talk all about the WGA East strategy of picketing filming locations. Quote, as a dual WGA-DGA member, I'm voting no on the deal. I think there's more to be had, especially on domestic streaming, and I don't think the numbers are, quote, historic given inflation.
And I think that is going to be a common perspective. I think that people who know that that one deal affects others and know that the deal that appears to be on the table for the DGA is not ultimately going to be beneficial for the WGA on most of the things that they seem to want, I think they have genuine and apparently tangible concerns, whereas the people who are only directors, again, can just point to, and look, you can go and you can find lots of threads from various different directors who want to point out all of the advances that are being made. And I don't think there's any question that there are advances being made in this deal. Obviously, of course there are, but are there enough? And what is the value of solidarity, and what is the value of stepping away from that solidarity is kind of where everyone is going to have to decide for themselves. Because it's not as if the DGA takes this deal, that suddenly there is going to be a deal that's going to make the writers and the actors happy. So you're going to have a bunch of directors who are going to have a deal, but no actual productions that they're capable of making. So great if the directors approve this deal. If the actors and writers are on strike, what has anyone gained?
Right. And if they do approve that, and then you see what SAG and WGA get, is there going to be, you know, immediate regret? So
the question of sort of whether sort of looking at the reactions, you know, to use the words that Stephen DeKnight used, the table scraps, you know, is this really table scraps? Is it maybe a full meal, but it's not as nourishing as it should be? Is it, I don't have the answer for that. And it's going to be very interesting to see what the vote looks like, and what the vote looks like along lines that we'll never see. We will not see those answers on whether Warren Light and Stephen DeKnight speak for the hyphenates, or whether, because they're more passionately out with the WGA, if they are speaking just as more as WGA members who see this as being a sign of insufficient solidarity coming after all of the previous professions of solidarity. So yeah, there's a lot happening here, and we don't know where it's going to end up with anyone.
Yeah, it's, as we like to say, a rapidly developing story. So lots going on here, and we'll continue to monitor it as we always do, and hopefully bring you some voices next time and return to the strike zone. Not a lot of people looking to do on the record press this week for some reason, even on the picket lines. So yeah, it's very, very interesting what's happening and how people are choosing to respond to this. A lot of people are saying that they need more time with the document because obviously it's very in-depth. And some people really just declining to comment because they don't want to, you know, put their opinions out there while other members are deciding for themselves. So will be interesting to see if that continues to be the narrative, or if people kind of start to come out more publicly beyond Twitter about their thoughts on this deal. So stay tuned as always.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Number five.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner. Among this week's major new launches, Peacock's Based on a True Story, The Crowded Room over at Apple, the final seasons of Never Have I Ever and Human Resources on Netflix, plus Arnold, which is a documentary about Arnold Schwarzenegger on a platform that I'm not entirely sure of. And Dan, since there were no screeners for it, I think you're going to weigh in on HBO's The Idol.
I am indeed. And the platform that you've probably heard of that's airing Arnold is Netflix.
Yeah, well, I should have. That was my guess, but I didn't want
to. Timed wholly logically to the release of FUBAR on Netflix, almost as if a puff piece documentary was in some way associated with the deal, though hard to know which part was wagging the dog or the tail or whatever.
Also, Wag the Dog is a great journalism movie.
Wag the Dog is a very, very, very fun movie. I have not watched it basically since it premiered, but it seemed prescient at the time, and I bet you it's even more prescient. Yes, so definitely going to address The Idol. We're in a sort of weird moment coming out of the end of May kind of Emmy contender avalanche, and then shifting into, it's not like necessarily these are shows getting dumped, but on the other hand, these are definitely all shows that if they were more logically and inherently Emmy contenders, probably someone would have attempted to premiere them last week or the week before, because Emmy voters don't have a long attention span, and these are all shows that are going to be long shots for any Emmy memory come a year from now. Also, I would say in the case of all three of them that there's really no Emmy consideration concerns whatsoever, particularly in the case of The Idol. But so that also has meant that you had The Idol, which premiered at Cannes, and critics were allowed to see the first two episodes if they happened to be on the ground in Cannes, but there were no screeners made available for critics who weren't in Cannes. But that's just one of those things. So while our colleague Lovia was able to see and review multiple episodes, I've only seen the one episode. And then at the same time, and again, these are all just sort of impediments on my/our abilities to do our job, both The Crowded Room and Based on a True Story had very peculiar do not reveal lists from their respective services, where in both of the cases of those two shows, the basic premise of the show was deemed something that was not supposed to be revealed, which is peculiar and annoying. But what can you do? So, yeah, let's talk quickly about The Idol. Leslie, did you check out The Idol on Sunday night?
No. I keep meaning to watch it, but yeah, there's been baseball on, and there's a couple of things going on in Hollywood. So
yeah, you really don't need to. What ultimately is most frustrating about it is that it's just really, really dull. It kind of goes in the same bucket to some degree as Citadel on Amazon, where all of the discussion of reshoots and budget and reconceptions and wild ambition and whatever, then when people settled in and watched the actual show, the large majority of the responses that I've seen and heard is, you know, as in, what was all the buzz about? What was all the whatever about? Somewhat similarly on The Idol, for all of the discussion of how risque and wild and whatever it is, it's really mostly just boring. It's so dull and tedious. And yes, there's a lot of prurient nonsense, but the idea that this was the revised version of the show that was made after they got rid of Amy Simons, after they got rid of much of the cast, after Sam Levinson basically took over the show, honestly, the idea of where anyone at HBO thought the money was going and why anyone thought it was a good idea. I understand that The Weeknd is a star and brings with him a certain amount of buzz and attention, but I would love to hear an HBO executive justify the cost of this show on an artistic level, because it's just bad. There's nothing to it that I would be able to latch on to. It's as a positive, its version of celebrity culture and entertainment culture and sort of industry satire is very bland and not especially funny. And the writing on the show is consistently dismal and superficial and really, really glib, you know, characters joking about how the character played by The Weeknd he looks rapey, and someone's like, haha, that's what I like about him. And it's dismal writing. The directing, it has a sort of flashy but hollow visual style, and more hollow than Euphoria, which is also a show that I've never really warmed to in the way that some people do. But the thing that Euphoria has always had going for it is its top to bottom cast has always been excellent. And so a lot of the humorous aspects of the show play because the cast makes them play. And then a lot of the dramatic elements of the show play because Zendaya is very, very effective. And much of the cast is very, very effective. There really is nothing comparable here that's keeping anything held together. The Weeknd is a complete and total blank slate of an actor. He's not in any way charismatic as a performer in this context. Lily Rose Depp playing a pop singer named Jocelyn, because that's a valid name for a pop singer, who's sort of a blend of Britney Spears and Miley Cyrus, I guess. She's not bad, and whatever the show is asking her to do, she's engaged with it, and it's kind of harrowing stuff and involves a lot of sexy dancing and nudity, none of which is really all that sexy. It's definitely just graphic. Watching an episode, some of the supporting actors every once in a while are doing kind of funny things, but mostly there's a lot of caricatured supporting performances. I don't have a clue what Hank Azaria is doing as a very, very stereotypical kind of Israeli, but not really effectively, mostly just a caricature as a manager of the pop star. I would go so far as to say there's a lot of stuff with the Jewishness of several of the characters. Eli Roth plays another that is pretty right on the edge of anti-Semitic. The question of whether you want to think that that's a commentary by Sam Levinson and company, or whether it's just playing into stereotypes, I can let people decide if they feel that it's progressive or whatever. I kept scratching my head and going, yeah, that's a little bit gross, and I get it. That character is supposed to be stereotypically Jewish, and you know, it's kind of right on the edge of Kanye West territory about who runs the industry. And then just a lot of people who feel overqualified for this. Jane Addams has several lines of dialogue, but I felt truly kind of embarrassed for her. She is too good an actress to be asked to do such garbage. This is just not a good show, and it's exactly the reason why everybody does pilots. HBO is in the pilot business. There should have been the opportunity to say at multiple points, we don't have this show yet. Maybe we shouldn't make the show until we know what the show is. It sounds like they had that. They did almost all of it under different auspices, and this is what the result was.
And they had to contend with The Weeknd's touring schedule.
Yeah, I don't understand it. And also watching this, I don't know how much it actually cost. I assume the answer is a ridiculous amount, but there's no indication of on screen of why this would be an expensive TV show. It's The first episode is mostly set in a badly art designed nightclub and in a very, very fancy Hollywood Hills type home. But it doesn't look great. There's no real opulence to it. It's really just a bad show, and not really a bad show in an entertaining way. Like, I think honestly that Euphoria is frequently a bad show, but even when it is a bad show, I can always find things to latch onto in Euphoria. Even if I'm like, oh God, this is exploitative and leering and prurient, which I often think that Euphoria is, I can always find something to latch onto. It's gorgeously shot. Cinematography on that show, beautiful. Almost every performance on that show, excellent. It also has significantly more and more effective humor than The Idol. I don't know. But again, critics were not sent screeners. People at Cannes saw two episodes. I don't know that I've talked to anyone who thought that the second episode was a dramatic improvement. And also, if the second episode were significantly better, if the third episode were significantly better, I believe that HBO would have made sure that critics saw it so as to avoid eviscerating it on the basis of one episode. But no such gestures have been made. This just feels like a show that really just shouldn't have been made, where someone should have just said, we don't have a show, let's not make this show. And I don't understand why it actually ended up getting made. So that is The Idol. And am I going to watch multiple more episodes of The Idol? Yes, I probably will. But I couldn't tell you why. And also, I gave it my pretty full attention the first episode. I was latched on. I was trying to find whatever it was that I was supposed to be finding perceptive or clever or whatever about it. I think it will move towards the background viewing or the whatever subsequently. So anyway, but also, as I suggested, the other new things aren't especially great either. The Crowded Room, for anyone who knows, I didn't even realize until I was a good deal into it that it was based on The Minds of Billy Milligan, the Daniel Keyes nonfiction novel, however one wants to phrase it. And I can't say what that was based on or what the premise of it is, because that's part of the thing that we're not supposed to reveal, which is so strange. Akiva Goldsman created the show for television. It's been in development for decades as a feature, many different forms. And once you see it, you understand in a kind of general sense why multiple directors would have thought and writers would have thought it was an interesting thing to want to try doing, and certainly why it would have been very interesting for a bunch of young actors to think they wanted to be involved with. You can see why they'd want to do it. But explaining why Akiva Goldsman was drawn to do it would require saying what the premise of the show was, and critics aren't allowed to discuss that, which is so strange. Like, he talks about how he was driven to make the show because he wanted to do an empathetic portrait of, and here I'm putting redacted, because I can't tell you, because the first thing it says in the do not reveals is don't reveal it's about that. So he wanted it to be an empathetic portrait of this, but no critic can discuss the thing it's supposed to be an empathetic portrait of. Also, it's really not. It's just a badly, badly conceived version of a potentially great story. There is no way that this should have been a 10-episode series. This should have been, it should have been a movie. It could have been a 4 or 6 hour limited series at 10 episodes. And with the quote unquote twist not being revealed until more than halfway through, it's just a structural mess. And having gotten to the twist in the series, it is impossible to understand what the rest of the series is even supposed to be, because the twist becomes all that anything is. And it's not a surprising twist for a variety of reasons, not the least of it being that it's based on an established book that's based on a a historical personage who in some period of time was reasonably public and significant. It's just not going to fool a lot of people. And then once people get to the twist and it's revealed what they've been fooled on, there's no next step. There's no thing that says, okay, now that I know this twist, I'm interested in this story for this reason. There's none of that. And it's another show with a very, very good cast. You have Tom Holland as the main character who's arrested in the first scene for reasons. And over the course of a number of episodes, he's being interrogated by a character played by Amanda Seyfried. And it's hard for me to exactly tell you what that character is because her profession is also embargoed. Makes no sense whatsoever. You have Emmy Rossum playing the Tom Holland character's mother, and it's kind of a confusing thing because she's mostly playing the character in flashbacks. So you go, okay, I guess that makes some sense, but then you still have Tom Holland playing the character. So there's a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, well, there's about an 8-year difference between them. Not a very big difference. And some of the acting is good and entertaining. I think Tom Holland's pretty solid. I think Emmy Rossum doesn't have a lot to do, but when she does, I think she's very good. Amanda Seyfried is, when you eventually get to the episode that's based around what the character is and does and who the character is as a person, I think she's great. I think you're going to watch 4 or 5 episodes going, why did they need an actor of that profile to play the role? But eventually you'll find the answer if you still care. My biggest takeaway here really and truly is that there's a 4 to 6 hour version of this that would be really good, and that 10 hours is by no stretch of the imagination how long this should have been. This is just not what the story was designed to carry, and the decision to treat the entire premise of the show as a spoiler, which is also, the show itself does that. Like, I understand why Apple TV thinks that for the show they released, people shouldn't spoil what the conceit of the show is. I just don't understand why that was the conceit of the show. It treats a thing that Akiva Goldsman wanted to treat seriously as a cheap twist, as opposed to the empathetic thing that he wanted to treat it as. And yeah, it's just a bad structural idea. My feeling is that the thing that the show turns out to be, it should have revealed itself to be that at the end of one episode, and then it could have actually been an empathetic portrayal as opposed to just a slick and somewhat glib portrayal of a serious thing. So not a huge fan, unfortunately, of The Crowded Room. And also, this is just one of those weeks, not a huge fan of Based on a True Story either. Though at least Based on a True Story is only 8 episodes. They're only a half hour. They do move fairly quickly. Sometimes they're funny. And I think that for the first 4 episodes of it, I found it amusing enough. So the basic premise of that, so far as I'm able to reveal, is that Kaley Cuoco and Chris Messina play a West Side Los Angeles couple. They're expecting their first child, but their marriage is a little bit strained because their lives are unfulfilled. They have friends who are living the Hollywood dream and they are not. But they see an opportunity when a true crime obsessed character played by Kaley Cuoco discovers that somebody they know, somebody in their sphere, is very possibly the serial killer known as the West Side Ripper. She is a true crime aficionado and decides to basically propose doing a podcast, true crime podcast, where they interview the serial killer. So lots of talk about podcast storytelling and stereotyping, and lots of talk about the true crime genre. If this sounds an awful lot like Only Murders in the Building, it really kind of is. The tone is not identical, obviously. This is a much more LA take on the story. It lacks the kind of semi-sophisticated wordplay of Only Murders. And ultimately, it kind of lacks ideas. For the first 4 episodes, there's fun to be had. There are some entertaining performances. I think that Kaley Cuoco and Chris Messina are both very good. I think that Tom Bateman, who plays their new plumber, is okay and seems to be having fun. Bunch of supporting people who are entertaining, and some of the stuff about podcasting is amusing. And then it just probably around mid-season, the characters go to Crime Con in Las Vegas, and some wild things happen at Crime Con. But then once it gets back, every episode is doing the exact same thing. It becomes a very, very redundant structure of, ooh, is this person going to find out? What are we going to do with this person? What's going to happen? Is the West Side Ripper going to kill them? Okay, if they do kill them, how are we going to dispose of the body, etc.? It just becomes really, really slick and repetitive. And also, allegedly, some parts of this story actually are based on true stories relating to Craig Rosenberg, the series's creator. You would have no idea, based on watching this, that any part of this story was real. No part of it feels as if it's a thing that was based on true story. So whatever was real has been so thoroughly co-opted by comedic and dramatic conventions that it's unrecognizable as a true experience for anybody, much less one related to the writer who wrote the story. Again, I like the stars. This is a thing that Kaley Cuoco, it's very similar to her performance in The Flight Attendant, which I think is a great performance. And I think this is a very good performance. It's just not a very well-written character, but none of them are. But at 8 episodes and half an hour apiece, you can make your way through it quickly. But boy, when it got to the end of 8 episododes, I thought it should have been a close-ended series, and nothing about where it suggests things are going for the second season is even the least bit interesting to me. So, oh well. So going back, though, to other various things premiering, Arnold is a 3-hour commercial for Arnold Schwarzenegger. It is not a 3-hour commercial that ignores problematic things in Arnold Schwarzenegger's life. It acknowledges his infidelities that led to his divorce. It acknowledges the LA Times reporting when he was running for governor of over a half dozen women accusing him of harassment and groping and other things. It just acknowledges all of those things within a very hagiographic celebration of Arnold Schwarzenegger as a particularly American icon. It takes kind of a 3-act structure on his life. So ultimately, his time as a bodybuilder is given almost identical screen time to his time as a movie star, which seems like a strange choice to me, because his time as a bodybuilder has very few people available to talk about it. His time as a movie star has many people available to talk about it, and yet feels incredibly rushed. Ditto with his time as governor of California. I don't know that I learned anything. Some of the interviews are amusing. It is not as if Arnold Schwarzenegger is not a game and gregarious storyteller. And since he is basically the steering force of this documentary, he gets to tell his story however he wants to. And there's almost no pushback on anything. It's simultaneously too long and too short. You know, it could have been longer if people had wanted to go into more depth on aspects of Arnold Schwarzenegger's career, or it could have been 2 hours, one or the other. This isn't right. And then finally, also premiering on the Netflix, is the fourth and final season of Never Have I Ever. I've watched half of the season so far, and honestly, I've watched only half of it in part because I want to drag it out a little. It's not one of my favorite shows on TV, but it's a show I like, and it's a show that I think is a wonderful piece of casual viewing television. It's just a fun show to settle in at 22 minutes per episode and laugh a little, and like the very, very game cast. Little bit sad that it's coming to an end, but you know, the fact that it got four seasons in today's Netflix environment borders on miraculous. How many shows at this point on Netflix are actually getting 4 seasons and are actually getting to resolve kind of on their own terms?
Not many.
Very, very few. I know this is one that you're a big fan of. Have you watched the 4th season yet, or have you not gotten to it yet? Lots of TV.
I've watched the first couple episodes of the final season, and it's comfort food. It's a great show to watch when you're just like mentally, when I need to not think about the strike or what the Dodgers are doing about pride and that nonsense. It's a perfect show to just get lost in that
completely world. And similarly, you know, the Mindy Kaling produced Sex Lives of College Girls. I think they're very, very similar in terms of in terms of their tone and in terms of just having these shows on as I'm tired of giving 100% attention to things I would like to watch at 75%. I think these are really, really entertaining shows. I think that the young cast on Never Have I Ever remains very, very good. It's not a show that I will ever list among my favorite shows on TV, and yet it's a show that when it's coming back, I go, yay, I can happily watch 10 more episodes of this show. And I like shows like that. I need a handful more shows like that, that I don't need to treat in terms of what are its Emmy hopes? Who is going to be a sleeper contender for supporting actor nominations? No, I sometimes just like watching a show where I can chuckle a little bit with the characters and find some emotional resonance in their world. And I think Never Have I Ever continues to be a show that does that.
Get into Ghosts for exactly the same reasons, Dan.
I do have the entire second half of the second season of Ghosts, so maybe that's where I will transition to. Definitely another show where I can enjoy the ensemble and find some things amusing in each episode without needing to break my brain trying to find its bigger value. I can just enjoy what it is. So Never Have I Ever, honestly, Never Have I Ever is my favorite of the things premiering this week, because to rehash, The Idol on HBO is just pretty much, unfortunately, straight up garbage. It is definitely exploitative and definitely really just there was the gap on Sunday night viewing between Succession and The Idol. In terms of acting, in terms of writing, in terms of directing, it is just falling off a cliff, and it's too bad because, you know, I like to enjoy my HBO programming. Crowded Room, you'll probably figure out the twist and you'll definitely be wondering why you want to keep watching it, but there are good actors in it and that might keep you engaged. Some humor in Only Murders in Mar Vista, or rather based on a true story. Always fun to watch Kaley Cuoco and Chris Messina, but second half of the season, definitely not as good as the first. And Arnold is a commercial for Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you need such a commercial? I cannot say for sure.
Well, for more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for more. This feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Next week, we have something that we're not ready to tease specifically yet, but if it comes together, it should be something that's hella fun. So we're looking forward
hella
to that.
Fun.
We don't want to spoil it. It is a definite deviation from format, and thus we don't want to say too much, but if it comes together, it's going to be a really cool thing for next week.
Yeah. And have a lot of voices. I'll say that. That's your clue.
Quite,
that's the only clue.
Quite literally. So yes, be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. Those suckers help spread the word of mouth. We're always happy to chat with you guys on Twitter. Let us know what's working, what isn't working, etc., etc. If you have questions for future mailbag segments, though, email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That's tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? a woo-hoo-er, a hand clapper, a high-fiver. I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.